coming to him, Bass said from where he stood at the door, and you were mooning over your lady love something fierce. Coat looked up. I do not moon, Bast. Chronicler picked up his flat leather satchel and produced a sheet of paper three-quarters full of small, precise writing. I can read the last bit back to you, if you'd like. Coat held out his hand. I can remember your cipher well enough to read it for myself, he said wearily. Give it over. Maybe it will prime the pump. He glanced over at Bast. Come and sit if you're going to listen. I won't have you hovering. Bast scampered for a seat while Coat drew a deep breath and looked over the last page of yesterday's story. The innkeeper was quiet for a long moment. His mouth made something that might have been the beginning of a frown, then something like a faint shadow of a smile. He nodded thoughtfully, his eyes still on the page. So much of my young life was spent trying to get to the university, he said. I wanted to go there even before my troop was killed, before I knew the Chandrian were more than a campfire story, before I began searching for the Aemir. The innkeeper leaned back in his chair, his weary expression fading, becoming thoughtful instead. I thought once I was there, things would be easy. I would learn magic and find the answers to all my questions. I thought it would all be storybook simple. Quoth gave a slightly embarrassed smile, the expression making his face look surprisingly young. And it might have been, if I didn't have a talent for making enemies and borrowing trouble. All I wanted was to play my music, attend my classes, and find my answers. Everything I wanted was at the university. All I wanted was to stay. He nodded to himself. That's where we should begin. The innkeeper handed the sheet of paper back to Chronicler, who absent-mindedly smoothed it down with one hand. Chronicler uncapped his ink and dipped his pen. Bast leaned forward eagerly, grinning like an excited child. Kvolf's bright eyes flickered around the room, taking everything in. He drew a deep breath and flashed a sudden smile, and for a brief moment looked nothing like an innkeeper at all. His eyes were sharp and bright, green as a blade of grass. Ready? Chapter 3. Luck. Every term at the university began the same way. The admissions lottery followed by a full span of interviews. They were a necessary evil of sorts. I don't doubt the process started sensibly. Back when the university was smaller, I could picture them as actual interviews, an opportunity for a student to have a conversation with the masters about what he had learned, a dialogue, a discussion. But these days, the university was host to over 1,000 students. There was no time for discussion. Instead, each student was subjected to a hail of questions in a handful of minutes. Brief as the interviews were, a single wrong answer or overlong hesitation could have a dramatic impact on your tuition. Before interviews, students studied obsessively. Afterward, they drank in celebration or to console themselves. Because of this, for the 11 days of admissions, most students looked anxious and exhausted at best. At worst, they wandered the university like shamblemen, hollow-eyed and gray-faced from too little sleep, too much drink, or both. Personally, I found it odd how seriously everyone else took the whole process. The vast majority of students were nobility or members of wealthy merchant families. For them, a high tuition was an inconvenience, leaving them less pocket money to spend on horses and whores. The stakes were higher for me. Once the masters set a tuition, it couldn't be changed. So if my tuition was set too high, I'd be barred from the university until I could pay. The first day of admissions always had a festival air about it. The admissions lottery took up the first half of the day, which meant the unlucky students who drew the earliest slots were forced to go through their interviews mere hours afterward. By the time I arrived, long lines snaked through the courtyard, while the students who had already drawn their tiles milled about, complaining and attempting to buy, sell, or trade their slots. I didn't see Willem or Simon anywhere, so I settled into the nearest line and tried not to think of how little I had in my purse, 1 talent and 3 jots. At one point in my life, it would have seemed like all the money in the world, but for tuition, it was nowhere near enough. There were carts scattered about selling sausages and chestnuts, hot cider and beer. I smelled warm bread and grease from a nearby cart. It was stacked with pork pies for the sort of people who could afford such things. The lottery was always held in the largest courtyard of the university. Most everyone called it the Pennant Square, though a few folk with longer memories referred to it as the Questioning Hall. I knew it by an even older name, the House of the Wind. I watched a few leaves tumble around the cobblestones, and when I looked up, I saw Fella staring back at me from where she stood 30 or 40 people closer to the front of the line. She gave me a warm smile and a wave. I waved back, and she left her place, strolling back to where I stood. Fella was beautiful. The sort of woman you would expect to see in a painting. Not the elaborate artificial beauty you often see among the nobility. Fella was natural and unself-conscious, with wide eyes and a full mouth that was constantly smiling. Here in the university, where men outnumbered women 10 to 1, she stood out like a horse in a sheepfold. "Do you mind if I wait with you?" she asked as she came to stand beside me. "I hate not having anyone to talk to." She smiled winsomely at the pair of men queued up behind me. "I'm not cutting in," she explained. "I'm just moving back." They had no objections, though their eyes flickered back and forth between Fella and myself. I could almost hear them wondering why one of the most lovely women in the university would give up her place in line to stand next to me. It was a fair question. I was curious myself. I moved aside to make space for her. We stood shoulder to shoulder for a moment, neither of us speaking. "What are you studying this term?" I asked. Fella brushed her hair back from her shoulder. "I'll keep up with my work in the archives, I suppose. Some chemistry, and Brander has invited me into manifold maths." I shivered a bit. Too many numbers. I can't swim those waters. Fella gave a shrug, and the long, dark curls of hair she'd brushed away took the opportunity to tumble back, framing her face. "It's not so hard once you get your head around it. It's more like a game than anything." She cocked her head at me. "What about you?" "Observation in the Medica," I said. "Study and work in the fishery. Sympathy, too, if Dahl will have me. I should probably brush up on my Siaru, too." "You speak Siaru?" she asked, sounding surprised. "I can get by," I said, "but Will says my grammar is embarrassingly bad." Fella nodded, then looked sideways at me, biting her lip. "Elodin's asked me to join his class, too," she said, her voice thick with apprehension. "Elodin's got a class?" I asked. "I didn't think they let him teach." "He's starting it this term," she said, giving me a curious look. "I thought you'd be in it. Didn't he sponsor you to Relar?"
"He did," I said.
"Oh," she looked uncomfortable, then quickly added, "He probably just hasn't asked you yet, or he's planning on mentoring you separately." I waved her comment aside, though I was stung at the thought of being left out. "Who can say with Elodin?" I said. "If he isn't crazy, he's the best actor I've ever met." Fella started to say something, then looked around nervously and moved closer to me. Her shoulder brushed mine, and her curling hair tickled my ear as she quietly asked, "Did he really throw you off the roof of the crockery?" I gave an embarrassed chuckle. "That's a complicated story," I said, then changed the subject rather clumsily. "What's the name of his class?" She rubbed her forehead and gave a frustrated laugh. "I haven't the slightest idea. He said the name of the class was the name of the class." She looked at me. "What does that mean? When I go to ledgers and lists, will it be there under the name of the class?" I admitted I didn't know, and from there it was a short step to sharing Elodin's stories. Fella said a scriv had caught him naked in the archives.
I'd heard that he'd once spent an entire span walking around the university blindfolded. Fella heard he'd invented an entire language from the ground up. I'd heard he had started a fistfight in one of the seedier local taverns because someone had insisted on saying the word utilize instead of use.
I heard that too, Fella said, laughing, except it was at the Horse and Four, and it was a baronet who wouldn't stop using the word moreover.
Before I knew it, we were at the front of the line.
Quoth, Arladin's son, I said.
The bored-looking woman marked my name, and I drew a smooth ivory tile out of the black velvet bag. It read, Felling, noon.
8th day of admissions, plenty of time to prepare.
Fella drew her own tile, and we moved away from the table.
What did you get? I asked.
She showed me her own small ivory tile, Kendling at 4th bell. It was an incredibly lucky draw, one of the latest slots available.
Wow. Congratulations.
Fella shrugged and slipped the tile into her pocket.
It's all the same to me. I don't make a special point of studying. The more I prepare, the worse I do. It just makes me nervous.
You should trade it away then, I said, gesturing to the milling throng of students. Someone would pay a full talent to get that slot. Maybe more.
I'm not much for bargaining either, she said. I just assume whatever tile I draw is lucky and stick to it.
Free from the line, we didn't have any excuse to stay together, but I was enjoying her company, and she didn't seem terribly eager to run off, so the two of us wandered the courtyard aimlessly, the crowd milling around us.
I'm starving, Fella said suddenly. Do you want to go have an early lunch somewhere?
I was painfully aware of how light my purse was. If I were any poorer, I'd have to put a rock in it to keep it from flapping in the breeze. My meals were free at Anchors because I played music there, so spending money on food somewhere else, especially so close to admissions, would be absolute foolishness.
I'd love to, I said honestly.
Then I lied. But I should browse around here a bit and see if anyone is willing to trade slots with me. I'm a bargainer from way back.
Fella fished around in her pocket. If you're looking for more time, you can have mine.
I looked at the tile between her finger and thumb, sorely tempted.
2 extra more days of preparation would be a godsend. Or I could make a talent by trading it away. Maybe 2.
I wouldn't want to take your luck, I said, smiling. And you certainly don't want any part of mine. Besides, you've already been too generous with me.
I drew my cloak around my shoulders pointedly.
Fella smiled at that, reaching out to run her knuckles across the front of the cloak.
I'm glad you like it, but as far as I'm concerned, I still owe you.
She bit at her lips nervously, then let her hand drop.
Promise me you'll let me know if you change your mind.
I promise. She smiled again, then gave a half wave and walked off across the courtyard. Watching her stroll through the crowd was like watching the wind move across the surface of a pond, except instead of casting ripples on the water, the heads of young men turned to watch her as she passed. I was still watching when Willem walked up beside me.
"Are you finished with your flirting, then?" he asked.
"I wasn't flirting," I said.
"You should have been," he said. "What is the point of me waiting politely, not interrupting, if you waste such opportunities?"
"It isn't like that," I said. "She's just friendly."
"Obviously," he said,
his rough Sealdish accent making the sarcasm in his voice seem twice as thick.
"What did you draw?"
I showed him my tile.
"You're a day later than me."
He held out his tile.
"I'll trade you for a jot."
I hesitated.
"Come now," he said. "It's not as if you can study in the archives like the rest of us."
I glared at him. "Your empathy is overwhelming."
"I save my empathy for those clever enough to avoid driving the master archivist into a frothing rage," he said. "For folks such as you, I only have a jot in trade. Would you like it or not?"
"I would like 2 jots, I said, scanning the crowd, looking for students with a desperate wildness around their eyes. "If I can get them." Willem narrowed his dark eyes.
A jot and three drabs, he said.
I looked back at him, eyeing him carefully. A jot and three, I said, and you take Simon as your partner the next time we play corners. He gave a huff of laughter and nodded. We traded tiles, and I tucked the money into my purse. One talent and four. A small step closer. After a moment's thought, I tucked my tile into my pocket.
Aren't you going to keep trading down? Will asked.
I shook my head. I think I'll keep this slot. He frowned.
Why? What can you do with 4 days except fret and thumb twiddle?
Same as anyone, I said. Prepare for my admissions interview.
How? He asked. You're still banned from the archives, aren't you?
There are other types of preparation, I said mysteriously. Willem snorted.
That doesn't sound suspicious at all, he said. And you wonder why people talk about you.
I don't wonder why they talk, I said. I wonder what they say. Chapter 4. Tar and Tin. The city that had grown up around the university over the centuries was not large. It was barely more than a town, really. Despite this, trade thrived at our end of the Great Stone Road. Merchants brought in carts of raw materials, tar and clay, gibstone, potash, and sea salt. They brought luxuries like Lanetti coffee and vintage wine. They brought fine dark ink from Arua, pure white sand for our glassworks, and delicately crafted sealedish springs and screws. When those same merchants left, their wagons were laden with things you could only find at the university. The Medica made medicines, real medicines, not colored stump water or penny nostrums. The alchemy complex produced its own marvels that I was only dimly aware of, as well as raw materials like naphtha, sulfurjack, and twice lime. I might be biased, but I think it's fair to say that most of the university's tangible wonders came from the artificery. Ground glass lenses, ingots of wolfram and glanz steel, sheets of gold so thin they tore like tissue paper. But we made much more than that. Sympathy lamps and telescopes, heat eaters and gear winds, salt pumps, trifoil compasses, a dozen versions of Teckham's winch and Delavari's axle. Artificers like myself made these things, and when merchants bought them, we earned a commission, 60% of the sale. This was the only reason I had any money at all, and since there were no classes during admissions, I had a full span of days to work in the fishery. I made my way to the stocks, the storeroom where artificers signed out tools and materials. I was surprised to see a tall, pale student standing at the window, looking profoundly bored.
Jackson? I asked.
What are you doing here? This is a scrub job. Jackson nodded morosely.
Gilvin is still a little vexed with me, he said. You know, the fire and everything.
Sorry to hear it, I said. Jackson was a full Ralar like myself. He could be pursuing any number of projects on his own right now. To be forced into a menial task like this wasn't just boring. It humiliated Jackson publicly while costing him money and stalling his studies. As punishments went, it was remarkably thorough.
What are we short on? I asked.
There was an art to choosing your projects in the fishery. It didn't matter if you made the brightest sympathy lamp or the most efficient heat funnel in the history of artificing. Until someone bought it, you wouldn't make a bent penny of commission. For a lot of the other workers, this wasn't an issue. They could afford to wait. I, on the other hand, needed something that would sell quickly. Jackson leaned on the counter between us.
Caravan just bought all our deck lamps, he said. We only have that ugly one of Vestin's left.
I nodded. Sympathy lamps were perfect for ships. Difficult to break, cheaper than oil in the long run, and you didn't have to worry about them setting fire to your ship. I juggled the numbers in my head. I could make 2 lamps at once, saving some time through duplication of effort, and be reasonably sure they would sell before I had to pay tuition. Unfortunately, deck lamps were pure drudgery. 40 hours of painstaking labor, and if I botched any of it, the lamp simply wouldn't work. Then I would have nothing to show for my time except a debt to the stocks for the materials I'd wasted. Still, I didn't have a lot of options.
"I guess I'll do lamps, then," I said.
Jaxum nodded and opened the ledger. I began to recite what I needed from memory. "I'll need 20 medium raw emitters, 2 sets of the tall moldings, a diamond stylus, a tentant glass, 2 medium crucibles, 4 ounces of tin, 6 ounces of fine steel, 2 ounces of nickel." Nodding to himself, Jaxum wrote it down in the ledger.
8 hours later, I walked through the front door of Anchors, smelling of hot bronze, tar, and coal smoke. It was almost midnight, and the room was empty except for a handful of dedicated drinkers.
"You look rough,"
Anchor said, as I made my way to the bar.
"I feel rough," I said.
"I don't suppose there's anything left in the pot." He shook his head.
"Folk were hungry tonight. I've got some cold potatoes I was going to throw in the soup tomorrow, and half a baked squash, I think."
"Sold," I said. "Though I'd be grateful for some salt butter as well." He nodded and pushed away from the bar. "Don't bother heating anything up," I said. "I'll just take it up to my room." He brought out a bowl with 3 good-sized potatoes and half a golden squash shaped like a bell. There was a generous daub of butter in the middle of the squash where the seeds had been scooped out. "I'll take a bottle of bread and beer, too," I said as I took the bowl, "with the cap on. I don't want to spill on the stairs." It was 3 flights up to my tiny room. After I closed the door, I carefully turned the squash upside down in the bowl, setting the bottle on top of it, and wrapped the whole thing in a piece of sackcloth, turning it into a bundle I could carry under one arm. Then, I opened my window and climbed out onto the roof of the inn. From there, it was a short hop over to the bakery across the alley. A piece of moon hung low in the sky, giving me enough light to see without making me feel exposed. Not that I was too worried. It was approaching midnight, and the streets were quiet. Besides, you would be amazed how rarely people ever look up. Ari sat on a wide brick chimney waiting for me. She wore the dress I had bought her and swung her bare feet idly as she looked up at the stars. Her hair was so fine and light that it made a halo around her head, drifting on the faintest whisper of a breeze. I carefully stepped onto the middle of a flat piece of tin roofing. It made a low thump under my foot, like a distant mellow drum. Ari's feet stopped swinging, and she went motionless as a startled rabbit. Then she saw me and grinned. I waved to her. Ari hopped down from the chimney and skipped over to where I stood, her hair streaming behind her.
"Hello, Kvothe."
She took a half step back.
"You reek."
I smiled my best smile of the day.
"Hello, Ari,"
I said. "You smell like a pretty young girl."
"I do,"
she agreed happily. She stepped sideways a little, then forward again, moving lightly on the balls of her bare feet.
"What did you bring me?"
she asked.
"What did you bring me?" I countered.
She grinned.
"I have an apple that thinks it's a pear," she said, holding it up, "and a bun that thinks it's a cat, and a lettuce that thinks it's a lettuce."
"It's a clever lettuce, then."
"Hardly," she said with a delicate snort. "Why would anything clever think it was a lettuce?"
"Even if it is a lettuce?" I asked.
"Especially then," she said. "Bad enough to be a lettuce. How awful to think you are a lettuce, too."
She shook her head sadly, her hair following the motion as if she were underwater. I unwrapped my bundle. "I brought you some potatoes, half a squash, and a bottle of beer that thinks it's a loaf of bread."
"What does the squash think it is?"
she asked curiously, looking down at it. She held her hands clasped behind her back. "It knows it's a squash," I said, "but it's pretending to be the setting sun."
"And the potatoes?" she asked.
"They're sleeping," I said. "And cold, I'm afraid." She looked up at me, her eyes gentle.
"Don't be afraid," she said, and reached out and rested her fingers on my cheek for the space of a heartbeat, her touch lighter than the stroke of a feather. "I'm here." You're safe.
The night was chill, and so rather than eat on the rooftops, as we often did, Ari led me down through the iron drainage grate and into the sprawl of tunnels beneath the university. She carried the bottle and held aloft something the size of a coin that gave off a gentle greenish light. I carried the bowl and the sympathy lamp I'd made myself, the one Kilvin had called a thieves' lamp. Its reddish light was an odd complement to Ari's brighter blue-green one. Ari brought us to a tunnel with pipes in all shapes and sizes running along the walls. Some of the larger iron pipes carried steam, and even wrapped in insulating cloth, they provided a steady heat. Ari carefully arranged the potatoes at a bend in the pipe where the cloth had been peeled away. It made a tiny oven of sorts. Using my sackcloth as a table, we sat on the ground and shared our dinner. The bun was a little stale, but it had nuts and cinnamon in it. The head of lettuce was surprisingly fresh, and I wondered where she had found it. She had a porcelain teacup for me and a tiny silver beggar's cup for herself. She poured the beer so solemnly you'd think she was having tea with the king. There was no talking during dinner. That was one of the rules I had learned through trial and error. No touching, no sudden movement, no questions even remotely personal. I could not ask about the lettuce or the green coin. Such a thing would send her scampering off into the tunnels, and I wouldn't see her for days afterward. Truth be told, I didn't even know her real name. Ari was just what I had come to call her, but in my heart, I thought of her as my little moon fae. As always, Ari ate delicately. She sat with her back straight, taking small bites. She had a spoon we used to eat the squash, sharing it back and forth. "You didn't bring your lute," she said, after we had finished eating. "I have to go read tonight," I said. "But I'll bring it soon." "How soon?"
6 nights from now," I said. I'd be finished with admissions then, and more studying would be pointless.
Her tiny face pulled a frown.
6 days isn't soon," she said. "Tomorrow is soon."
6 days is soon for a stone," I said.
"Then play for a stone in 6 days," she said, "and play for me tomorrow."
"I think you can be a stone for 6 days," I said. "It's better than being a lettuce."
She grinned at that. "It is."
After we finished the last of the apple, Ari led me through the underthing. We went quietly along the nodway, jumped our way through vaults, then entered billows, a maze of tunnels filled with a slow, steady wind. I probably could have found my own way, but I preferred to have Ari as a guide. She knew the underthing, like a tinker knows his packs. Willem was right. I was banned from the archives, but I've always had a knack for getting into places where I shouldn't be. More's the pity. Archives was a huge windowless stone block of a building, but the students inside needed fresh air to breathe, and the books needed more than that. If the air was too moist, the books would rot and mildew. If the air was too dry, the parchment would become brittle and fall to pieces. It had taken me a long time to discover how fresh air made its way into the archives, but even after I found the proper tunnel, getting in wasn't easy. It involved a long crawl through a terrifyingly narrow tunnel, a quarter hour worming along on my belly across the dirty stone. I kept a set of clothes in the underthing, and after barely a dozen trips were thoroughly ruined, the knees and elbows almost entirely worn out. Still, it was a small price to pay for gaining access to the archives. There would be hell to pay if I were ever caught. I'd face expulsion at the very least, but if I performed poorly in my admissions exam and received a tuition of 20 talents, I'd be just as good as expelled. So it was a horse apiece, really. Even so, I wasn't worried about being caught. The only lights in the stacks were carried by students and scribs. This meant it was always nighttime in the archives, and I have always been most comfortable at night.
Chapter 5. The Aeolian. The days trudged past. I worked in the fishery until my fingers were numb, then read in the archives until my eyes were blurry. On the 5th day of admissions, I finally finished my deck lamps and took them to stocks, hoping they sold quickly.
I considered starting another pair, but I knew I wouldn't have time to finish them before tuition was due. So I set about making money in other ways. I played an extra night at Anchor's, earning free drinks and a handful of small change from appreciative audience members. I did some piecework in the fishery, making simple, useful items like brass gears and panes of twice-tough glass. Such things could be sold back to the workshop immediately for a tiny profit. Then, since tiny profits weren't going to be enough, I made two batches of yellow emitters. When used to make a sympathy lamp, their light was a pleasant yellow very close to sunlight. They were worth quite a bit of money because doping them required dangerous materials. Heavy metals and vaporous acids were the least of them. The bizarre alchemical compounds were the truly frightening things. They were transporting agents that would move through your skin without leaving a mark, then quickly eat the calcium out of your bones. Others would simply lurk in your body, doing nothing for months until you started to bleed from your gums and lose your hair. The things they produced in alchemy complex made arsenic look like sugar in your tea. I was painstakingly careful, but while working on the second batch of emitters, my tentant glass cracked, and tiny drops of transporting agent spattered the glass of the fume hood where I was working. None of it actually touched my skin, but a single drop landed on my shirt, high above the long cuffs of the leather gloves I was wearing. Moving slowly, I used a nearby caliper to pinch the fabric of my shirt and pull it away from my body. Then, moving awkwardly, I cut the piece of fabric away so it had no chance at all of touching my skin. The incident left me shaken and sweating, and I decided there were better ways to earn money. I covered a fellow student's observation shift in the Medica in exchange for a jot, and helped a merchant unload 3 wagon loads of lime for 1/2 penny each. Then, later that night, I found a handful of cutthroat gamblers willing to let me sit in on their game of breath. Over the course of 2 hours, I managed to lose 18 pennies and some loose iron. Though it galled me, I forced myself to walk away from the table before things got any worse. At the end of all my scrambling, I had less in my purse than when I had begun. Luckily, I had one last trick up my sleeve. I stretched my legs on the wide stone road heading to Imre. Accompanying me were Simon and Willem. Will had ended up selling his late slot to a desperate scriv for a tidy profit, so both of them were finished with admissions and carefree as kittens. Will's tuition was set at 6 talents and 8, while Sim was still gloating over his impressively low 5 talents and 2. My purse held 1 talent and 3, an inauspicious number. Completing our quartet was Manette. His wild gray hair and habitually rumpled clothes made him look vaguely bewildered, as if he'd just woken up and couldn't quite remember where he was. We had brought him along partly because we needed a fourth for corners, but also because we felt it was our duty to get the poor fellow out of the university every once in a while. The four of us made our way over the high arch of Stonebridge, across the Omethi River, and into Imre. Autumn was in its last gasp, and I wore my cloak against the chance of a chill. My lute was slung comfortably across my back. At the heart of Imre, we crossed a great cobblestone courtyard and walked past the central fountain filled with statues of satyrs chasing nymphs. Water splashed and fanned in the breeze as we joined the line leading to the Aeolian. When we got to the door, I was surprised to see Diak wasn't there. In his place was a short, grim man with a thick neck. He held out a hand. "That'll be a jot, young sir." "Sorry." I moved the strap of my loot case out of the way and showed him the small set of silver pipes pinned to my cloak. I gestured to Will, Sim, and Manette. "They're with me." He squinted at the pipes suspiciously.
"You look awfully young," he said, his eyes darting back to my face.
"I am awfully young," I said easily. "It's part of my charm."
"Awfully young to have your pipes," he clarified, making it a reasonably polite accusation.
I hesitated. While I looked old for my age, that meant I looked a few years better than my actual 15. To the best of my knowledge, I was the youngest musician at the Aeolian. Normally, this worked in my favor, as it made me a bit of a novelty. But now, before I could think of anything to say, a voice came from the line behind us.
It's not a fake cat.
A tall woman carrying a fiddle case nodded at me.
He earned his pipes while you were away. He's the real thing.
Thanks, Marie, I said as the doorman gestured us inside. The four of us found a table near the back wall with a good view of the stage. I scanned the nearby faces and staved off a familiar flicker of disappointment when Denna was nowhere to be seen.
What was that business at the door?
Manette asked as he looked around, taking in the stage, the high, vaulted ceiling.
Were people paying to get in here?
I looked at him.
You've been a student for 30 years, but you've never been to the Aeolian?
Well, you know,
he made a vague gesture.
I've been busy. I don't get over to this side of the river very often.
Sim laughed, sitting down. Let me put this in terms you'll understand, Manette. If music had a university, this would be it, and Quoth would be a full-fledged arcanist.
Bad analogy, Will said. This is a musical court, and Quoth is one of the gentry. We ride his coattails in. It is the reason we have tolerated his troublesome company for so long.
A whole jot just to get in?
Manette asked. I nodded. Manette gave a noncommittal grunt as he looked around, eyeing the well-dressed nobles milling on the balcony above.
Well then, he said, I guess I learned something today.
The Aeolian was just beginning to fill up, so we passed the time playing corners. It was just a friendly game, a drab a hand, double for a counterfeit, but coin poor as I was, any stakes were high. Luckily, Manette played with the precision of a gear clock. No mislaid tricks, no wild bids, no hunches. Simon bought the first round of drinks, and Manette bought the second. By the time the Aeolian's lights dimmed, Manette and I were 10 hands ahead, largely due to Simon's tendency to enthusiastically overbid. I pocketed the single copper jot with grim satisfaction. 1 talent and 4. An older man made his way up onto the stage. After a brief introduction by Stanchion, he played a heart-achingly lovely version of Tatin's Late Day on mandolin. His fingers were light and quick and sure on his strings, but his voice... Most things fail with age. Our hands and backs stiffen, our eyes dim, skin roughens, and our beauty fades. The only exception is the voice. Properly cared for, a voice does nothing but grow sweeter with age and constant use. His was like a sweet honey wine. He finished his song to hearty applause, and after a moment, the lights came back up and the room swelled with conversation. There's breaks between the performers, I explained to Manette, so folk can talk and walk around and get their drinks. Talu and all his angels won't be able to keep you safe if you talk during someone's performance. Manette huffed.
Don't worry about me embarrassing you. I'm not a complete barbarian.
Just giving fair warning, I said.
You let me know what's dangerous in the artificery.
I let you know what's dangerous here.
His lute was different, Willem said. It sounded different than yours. Smaller, too.
I fought off the urge to smile and decided not to make an issue of it. That sort of lute is called a mandolin, I said.
You're going to play, aren't you?
Simon asked, squirming in his seat like an eager puppy. You should play that song you wrote about Ambrose. He hummed a bit, then sang, The mule can learn magic, a mule has some class, 'cause unlike young Rosie, he's just half an ass. Manette chuckled into his mug. Willem cracked a rare smile.
No, I said firmly. I'm done with Ambrose. We're quits as far as I'm concerned.
Of course,
Willem said, deadpan. I'm serious, I said. There's no profit in it. This back and forth does nothing but irritate the masters.
Irritate is rather a mild word, Manette said dryly. Not exactly the one I would have chosen myself.
You owe him, Sim said, his eyes glittering with anger. Besides, they aren't going to charge you with conduct unbecoming a member of the Arcanum just for singing a song.
No, Manette said. They'll just raise his tuition.
What? Simon said.
They can't do that. Tuition is based on your admissions interview.
Manette's snort echoed hollowly into his mug as he took another drink.
The interview is just a piece of the game. If you can afford it, they squeeze you a little. Same thing if you cause them trouble.
He eyed me seriously.
You're going to be getting it from both ends this time. How many times were you brought up on the horns last term?
Twice, I admitted. But the second time wasn't really my fault.
Of course,
Manette gave me a frank look.
And that's why they tied you up and whipped you bloody, is it? Because it wasn't your fault?
I shifted uncomfortably in my chair, feeling the pull of the half-healed scars along my back.
Most of it wasn't my fault, I amended.
Manette shrugged it aside.
Fault isn't the issue. A tree doesn't make a thunderstorm, but any fool knows where lightning's going to strike.
Willem nodded seriously.
Back home we say the tallest nail gets hammered down first.
He frowned.
It sounds better in Siaru.
Sim looked troubled.
But the admission interview still determines the lion's share of your tuition, doesn't it?
From his tone, I guessed Sim hadn't even considered the possibility of personal grudges or politics entering into the equation.
For the most part, Manette admitted, but the masters pick their own questions, and they each get their say.
He began to tick things off on his fingers.
Hem doesn't care for you, and he can carry twice his weight in grudges. You got on Lauren's bad side early and managed to stay there. You're a troublemaker. You missed nearly a span of classes toward the end of last term. No warning beforehand or any explanation afterward.
He gave me a significant look.
I looked down at the table, pointedly aware that several of the classes I'd missed had been part of my apprenticeship under Manette in the artificiary.
After a moment, Manette shrugged and continued.
On top of it all, they'll be testing you as a Relar this time around. Tuitions get higher in the upper ranks. There's a reason I've stayed an Elir this long.
He gave me a hard stare.
My best guess? You'll be lucky to get out for less than 10 talents.
10 talents? Sim sucked a breath through his teeth and shook his head sympathetically.
Good thing you're so flush.
Not as flush as that, I said.
How can you not be? Sim asked. The masters fined Ambrose almost 20 talents after he broke your loot. What did you do with all the money?
I looked down and nudged my loot case gently with my foot.
You spent it on a new loot? Simon asked, horrified. 20 talents? Do you know what you could buy for that amount of money?
A loot? Willem asked.
I didn't even know you could spend that much on an instrument, Simon said.
You can spend a lot more than that, Manette said. They're like horses.
This made the conversation stumble a bit. Will and Sim turned to look at him, confused. I laughed.
That's a good comparison, actually.
Manette nodded sagely.
There's a wide spread with horses, you see. You can buy a broken old plow horse for less than a talent, or you can buy a high-stepping Valder for 40.
Not likely, Will grunted. Not for a true Valder.
Manette smiled.
That's it exactly. However much you've ever known someone to spend on a horse, you could easily spend that buying yourself a fine harp or fiddle.
Simon looked stunned by this.
But my father once spent 250 hard on a Cape Sayan tall, he said.
I leaned to one side and pointed. The blonde man there? His mandolin is worth twice that.
But, Simon said, but horses have bloodlines. You can breed a horse and sell it.
That mandolin has a bloodline, I said. It was made by Antressor himself. It's been around for 150 years.
I watched as Sim absorbed the information, looking around at all the instruments in the room.
Still, Sim said, 20 talents.
He shook his head.
Why didn't you wait until after admissions? You could have spent whatever you had left over on the loot.
I needed it to play at Anchors, I explained. I get free room and board as their house musician. If I don't play, I can't stay.
It was the truth, but it wasn't the whole truth. Anchor would have cut me some slack if I'd explained my situation, but if I'd waited, I would have had to spend almost 2 span without a loot. It would be like missing a tooth or a limb. It would be like spending 2 span with my mouth sewn shut. It was unthinkable. And I didn't spend all of it on the loot, I said. I had a few other expenses crop up, too. Specifically, I'd paid off the Galet I'd borrowed money from. That had taken 6 talents, but being free of my debt to Davy was like having a great weight lifted off my chest. But now, I could feel that same weight settling back onto me. If Manette's guess was even half accurate, I was worse off than I'd thought. Fortunately, the lights dimmed and the room grew quiet, saving me from having to explain myself any further. We looked up as Stanchion brought Marie up onto the stage. He chatted with a nearby audience while she tuned her fiddle, and the room began to settle down. I liked Marie. She was taller than most men, proud as a cat, and spoke at least 4 languages. Many of Imre's musicians did their best to mimic the latest fashion, hoping to blend in with the nobility. But Marie wore road clothes, pants you could do a day's work in, boots you could use to walk 20 miles. I don't mean to imply she wore homespun, mind you. She just had no love for fashion or frippery. Her clothes were obviously tailored for her, close-fitting and flattering. Tonight, she wore burgundy and brown, the colors of her patron, the Lady Jael. The 4 of us eyed the stage.
I will admit, Willem said quietly, that I have given Marie a fair amount of consideration.
Manette gave a low chuckle.
That is a woman and a half, he said, which means she's 5 times more woman than any of you know what to do with.
At a different time, such a statement might have goaded the 3 of us into swaggering protest. But Manette stated it without a hint of taunt in his voice, so we let it pass, especially as it was probably true.
Not for me, Simmons said. She always looks like she's getting ready to wrestle someone, or go off and break a wild horse.
She does, Manette chuckled again. If we were living in a better age, they'd build a temple around a woman like that.
We fell silent as Marie finished tuning her fiddle and eased into a sweet roundel, slow and gentle as a soft spring breeze. Though I didn't have time to tell him, Simon was more than half right. Once, in the Flint and Thistle, I had seen Marie punch a man in the throat for referring to her as that mouthy fiddler bitch. She kicked him when he was on the ground, too, but only once, and nowhere that hurt him in a permanent way. Marie continued her roundel, the slow, sweet pace of it gradually building until it was trotting along briskly, the sort of tune you would only think of dancing to if you were exceptionally light on your feet or exceptionally drunk. She let it build until it was beyond anything a man could dream of dancing to. It was nothing like a trot now. It sprinted, fast as a pair of children racing. I marveled at how clean and clear her fingering was despite the frantic pace. Faster, quick as a deer with a wild dog behind it. I started to get nervous, knowing it was just a matter of time before she slid or slipped or dropped a note, but somehow she kept going, each note perfect, sharp and strong and sweet. Her flickering fingers arched high against the strings. The wrist of her bow hand hung loose and lazy despite the terrible speed. Faster still. Her face was intent, her bow arm a blur. Faster still. She braced herself, her long legs planted firmly on the stage, her fiddle tucked hard against her jaw, each note sharp as early morning bird song, faster still. She finished in a rush and gave a sudden flourishing bow without a single mistake. I was sweating like a hard-run horse, my heart racing. I wasn't the only one. Will and Sim each had a sheen of sweat across their foreheads. Manette's knuckles were white where he gripped the edge of the table.
"Merciful Taylu," he said breathlessly. "They have music like this every night?"
I smiled at him. "It's still early," I said. "You haven't heard me play." Willem bought the next round of drinks, and our talk turned to the idle gossip of the university. Manette had been around for longer than half of the Masters, so he knew more scandalous stories than the three of us put together. A lutist with a thick gray beard played a stirring version of Unfeant Mori. Then two lovely women, one in her 40s and the other young enough to be her daughter, sang a duet about Laniel Young again I'd never heard before. Marie was called back onto the stage and played a simple jig with such enthusiasm that it set folk dancing in the spaces between the tables. Manette actually stood for the final chorus and surprised us by demonstrating a pair of remarkably light feet. We cheered him, and when he took his seat again, he was flushed and breathing hard. Will bought him a drink, and Simon turned to me with excitement in his eyes. "No," I said. "I'm not going to play it. I already told you." Sim deflated into such profound disappointment that I couldn't help but laugh. "I'll tell you what. I'll take a turn around the place. If I see Threp, I'll put him up to it." I made my slow way through the crowded room, and while I did keep an eye out for Threp, the truth is I was hunting for Denna. I hadn't seen her come in by the front door, but with the music, cards, and general commotion, there was a chance I'd simply missed her. It took a quarter of an hour to methodically make my way through the crowded main floor, getting a look at all the faces and stopping to chat with a few of the musicians along the way. I made my way up to the second tier just as the lights dimmed again. I settled in at the railing to watch a Yiddish piper play a sad, lilting tune. When the lights came back up, I searched the second tier of the Aeolian, a wide, crescent-shaped balcony. My search was more a ritual than anything. Looking for Denna was an exercise in futility, like praying for fair weather. But tonight was the exception to the rule. As I strolled through the second tier, I spotted her walking with a tall, dark-haired gentleman. I changed my path through the tables so I would intercept them casually. Denna spotted me half a minute later. She gave a bright, excited smile and took her hand off the gentleman's arm, motioning me closer. The man at her side was proud as a hawk and handsome, with a jawline like a cinder brick. He wore a shirt of blindingly white silk and a richly dyed suede jacket the color of blood. Silver stitching. Silver on the buckle and the cuff. He looked every bit the Modegan gentleman. The cost of his clothes, not even counting his rings, would have paid my tuition for a solid year. Denna was playing the part of his charming and attractive companion. In the past, I had seen her dressed much the same as myself, plain clothes meant for hard wear and travel. But tonight, she wore a long dress of green silk. Her dark hair curled artfully around her face and tumbled down her shoulders. At her throat was an emerald pendant, shaped like a smooth teardrop. It matched the color of the dress so perfectly that it couldn't be coincidence. I felt a little shabby by comparison. More than a little. Every piece of clothing I owned in the world amounted to 4 shirts, 2 sets of pants, and a few sundries, all of it second-hand and threadbare to some degree. I was wearing my best tonight, but I'm sure you understand when I say my best was not particularly fine. The one exception was my cloak, Fella's gift. It was warm and wonderful, tailored for me in green and black with numerous pockets in the lining. It wasn't elegant by any measure, but it was the finest thing I owned. As I approached, Denna stepped forward and held out her hand for me to kiss. The gesture poised, almost haughty. Her expression was composed, her smile polite. To the casual observer, she looked every bit the genteel lady being gracious to a poor young musician. All except her eyes. They were dark and deep, the color of coffee and chocolate. Her eyes were dancing with amusement, full of laughter. Standing behind her, the gentleman gave a bare hint of a frown when she offered me her hand. I didn't know what game Denna was playing, but I could guess my part. So I bent over her hand, kissing it lightly in a low bow. I had been trained in courtly manners at an early age, so I knew what I was doing. Anyone can bend at the waist, but a good bow takes skill. This one was gracious and flattering. And as I pressed my lips to the back of her hand, I flared my cloak to one side with a delicate flick of my wrist. The last was the difficult bit, and it had taken me several hours of careful practice in the bathhouse mirror to get the motion to look sufficiently casual. Denna made a curtsy graceful as a falling leaf and stepped back to stand beside the gentleman.
Quoth, this is Lord Kellen Van Teneer.
Kellen?
Quoth.
Kellen eyed me up and down, forming his full opinion of me more quickly than you can draw a short, sharp breath. His expression became dismissive, and he gave me a nod. I am no stranger to disdain, but I was surprised how much this particular bit stung me.
At your service, my lord.
I made a polite bow and shifted my weight so my cloak fell away from my shoulder, displaying my talent pipes. He was about to look away with practiced disinterest when his eyes snagged on the bright piece of silver. It was nothing special in terms of jewelry, but here it was significant. Willem was right. At the Aeolian, I was one of the gentry. And Kellen knew it. After a heartbeat of consideration, he returned my bow. It was barely more than a nod, really, just low enough to be polite.
Yours and your family's,
he said in perfect Aeturin. His voice was deeper than mine, a warm bass with enough of a Modegan accent to lend it a slight musical cant. Denna inclined her head in his direction.
Kellen has been showing me my way around a harp. I am here to win my pipes, he said, his deep voice filled with certainty.
When he spoke, women at the surrounding tables turned to look in his direction with hungry, half-lidded eyes. His voice had the opposite effect on me. To be both rich and handsome was bad enough, but to have a voice like honey over warm bread on top of that was simply inexcusable. The sound of it made me feel like a cat grabbed by the tail and rubbed backward with a wet hand. I glanced at his hands.
So you're a harper?
Harpist, he corrected stiffly. I play the Pendenhale, king of instruments.
I pulled in half a breath, then closed my mouth. The Modegan great harp had been the king of instruments 500 years ago. These days, it was an antique curiosity. I let it pass, avoiding the argument for Denna's sake.
Will you be trying your luck tonight? I asked.
Kellen's eyes narrowed slightly.
There will be nothing of luck involved when I play. But no. Tonight I am enjoying my lady Danielle's company.
He lifted Denna's hand to his lips and gave it an absent-minded kiss. He looked around at the murmuring crowd in a proprietary way, as if he owned them.
I will be in worthy company here, I think.
I glanced at Denna, but she was avoiding my eyes. Her head tilted to the side as she toyed with an earring previously hidden in her hair, a tiny teardrop emerald that matched the pendant at her throat. Kellen's eyes flickered over me again, my ill-fitting clothes, my hair too short to be fashionable, too long to be anything other than wild.
And you are a piper?
The least expensive instrument.
Pipist, I said lightly. But no, I favor the lute.
His eyebrows went up.
You play court lute?
My smile stiffened a bit despite my best efforts.
Trooper's lute.
Ah, he said, laughing, as if things suddenly made sense.
Folk music.
I let that pass as well, though less easily than before. Do you have seats yet? I asked brightly. Several of us have taken a table below with a good view of this stage. You're welcome to join us.
The lady and I already have a table in the third circle.
Kellen nodded in Denna's direction.
I much prefer the company above.
Outside his field of vision, Denna rolled her eyes at me. I kept a straight face and made another polite bow to him, barely more than a nod.
I won't delay you then.
I turned to Denna.
My lady, might I call on you sometime?
She sighed, looking every bit the put-upon socialite except for her eyes, which were still laughing at all the ridiculous formality of the exchange.
I'm sure you understand, Quoth. My schedule is quite full for the next several days, but you could pay a visit near the end of the span if you wish. I've taken rooms at the Grey Man.
You're too kind, I said, and gave her a much more earnest bow than the one I had given Kellen. She rolled her eyes at me this time. Kellen held out his arm, turning his shoulder to me in the process, and the two of them walked off into the crowd. Watching them together, moving gracefully through the throng, it would be easy to believe they owned the place, or were perhaps thinking of buying it to use as a summer home. Only old nobility move with that easy